Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hi everyone, good evening. Thank you all so much for coming. My name is Tito Moloku and I'm the General Secretary of the LSE-SU, and I'm just here to welcome you to this amazing event. So I'll just give you a brief overview of this event. So as you can see, this event is entitled Homelessness in London, Why Youth Homelessness Needs Its Own Solution. So the LSE-HI, or the LSE Homelessness Initiative, was formed to respond to the homelessness crisis within our most affected areas in London and in the UK. Following a motion passed by the LSE Students' Union in 2020, the school and the LSE-SU partnered with St Mungo's, one of the country's leading homelessness charities, to target this issue on our campus. After working in partnership with St Mungo's for the first 2 years, LSE-HI continues to bring together students and staff from across a wide range of departments in the school. We hope to raise awareness, provide information, and organise volunteering opportunities for all to get involved in. Among other contributions, the partnership with St Mungo's has provided training for LSE security staff on how to best engage with rough sleepers on our campus. But also, all members of the LSE community have now learned how to play a part in providing support for all. In October last year, the LSE-HI hosted the event, Homelessness in London in a Time of Crisis, to address the fact that London accounts for around 60% of all households in temporary accommodation in England. The event looked at the reasons why the situation has worsened over time, the consequences for individuals facing homelessness, and the consequences for London's local authorities, and the impact of proposed policy changes. So to give you some background to today's event, in March 2024, colleagues in the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion, or CASE, published a report and this was carried out in partnership with the New Horizon Youth Centre. And following the report's publication, CASE reached out to the LSE-HI to collaborate on an event dedicated to the issue of youth homelessness in London specifically. This event is part of the ERSC Festival of Social Science in 2024, taking place from the 19th of October to the 9th of November, with events across the UK. Now I'm going to hand over to Tanya Burkhard. Thank you all and welcome to the event.
Thank you very much indeed, Tito, and welcome from me also, Tanya Burkhart, Associate Director in the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion. And welcome also to our online audience, because we're also online and the event is being recorded and will be made available, all things technical permitting, as a podcast after today's event. So the format that we're going to follow today is that I will shortly introduce the members of the panel here, and each will speak for around 10 minutes. And then we will open up for question and answer from you, the audience, and also our online audience. If you can remember, please, to wait for the roving microphone. I will remind you at the time, people in the hall, that's so that our online audience can hear your questions as well. So Tito's given us a really important introduction to the issue of why homelessness is so relevant and important for us here in LSE. But why specifically youth homelessness, the focus of today's event? Well, 135,000 people aged 16 to 24 presented themselves as homeless to their local authority in the most recent year for which we have data. And 20,000 of those were here in London. So this is a huge problem. And each one of those 20,000 people, each one of those 135,000 people, have their own story, their own experience, their own route into homelessness. But collectively, that group of young people have a distinctive profile, have distinctive routes into homelessness as compared to other forms of homelessness, but also distinct experiences and distinct consequences for their subsequent life chances. So that's one of the reasons why youth homelessness needs its own attention and its own solutions. And that's really what we hope to do through the event today. We're going to explore how and why youth homelessness has increased. We're going to try and understand what is distinctive about it, the challenges that local authorities and the voluntary sector have in trying to tackle this problem of homelessness, and most importantly, perhaps, what can be done about it, what we can actually practically suggest. So I'm going to turn first to Lily Walker, who is Assistant Director of Activism and Advocacy at Shelter. She was previously Head of Policy, Research and Campaigns at Centrepoint, which many of you will have heard of. Before that, she had roles in the Treasury and Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that bit, Lily. Is that a secret past? And what Lily's going to discuss is the political landscape for tackling homelessness and the economic benefits of tackling this issue. Thanks, Lily.
Thank you so much. I'm quite loud, but I'm hoping that I can get to the microphone. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you everyone for being here for this really important discussion and topic. There's a lot that I could say, and so I've tried to drill it down into a bit of a speech, so hopefully I won't be too formulaic, but I'm going to read it through a speech. But yeah, there's a lot that I can say, and I've provided quite a global picture of the issue, but hopefully if there are any London-specific questions, we can get into that in the Q&A afterwards. But I'd like to open with quite a stark framing. This morning, I was at the annually held commemoration service for people who have died whilst homeless in London. A church packed full of people working in and around the homeless sector paid our respects to around 200 people who died in the last year whilst homeless in London. Some of those people were known to some of us in attendance. However, over 40 of the people who died whilst homeless in London last year remain unnamed. The average age of death of a man experiencing homelessness in the UK is 47. For a woman experiencing homelessness, the average age of death is 43. The majority of those deaths occur here in London. And those stats mean that for people experiencing homelessness in London, by their early 20s, they have hit middle age. And when we talk about youth homelessness, we are talking about 16 to 25-year-olds. Do you consider that to be middle-aged? Please keep that life expectancy statistic in mind when you consider the lived experience of the thousands of young people facing homelessness and navigating the UK's housing and homelessness system alone today. Now, there's a well-known proverb that goes, "It takes a village to raise a child." But what happens to a child if they don't have a village? If their village has abandoned them? If it was dangerous, or if it simply couldn't raise them? The point that I'm making is that one of the leading causes of youth homelessness is family breakdown. And more importantly, if policy, and specifically government, doesn't intervene to ensure that vulnerable young people can access the stabilising forces of housing, education, finances that a family or a village would normally provide, then who will? To give you some statistics from my former employer, Centrepoint, 39.4% of people calling the Centrepoint helpline have called because of family breakdown. 58% of Centrepoint residents left their last home because of relationship breakdown. Young people facing homelessness do not have a safety net. There's nowhere to go, and they are at the sharpest end of the cost of living crisis. To end youth homelessness once and for all, government must step in. We have a new government, and with it, the hope of meaningful change. But first, let's delve into where young people sit within the current political landscape. Everyone in this room will have experienced the impact of the cost of living crisis, whether as an individual or a business or part of a business, as a family member or a friend. It's become an inescapable fact that costs are escalating, and simply getting by is not that easy for a lot of people. And whilst the country battles this escalating cost of living, the youth homelessness sector has witnessed the remarkable resilience of the young people that we serve, who, having navigated the impact of a global pandemic, two sovereigns, five prime ministers, a cost of living crisis, and nine housing ministers, all in the last 4 years, they might feel that they're in ever perpetual crisis. And whilst their resilience must be recognised and commended, it's not fair for it to be expected. More research from Centrepoint found that almost half of 16 to 25-year-olds have gone to bed hungry in the last 12 months. More than a third of young people have gone a whole day without food. Almost half of young people surveyed say their income is not enough to get by. And over a quarter of homeless young people surveyed are living off less than £5 a week, specifically £4.60 after their rent and bills are paid. Now, whilst the moral case for ending youth homelessness is clear, the economic case is also airtight. According to research, the cost to the public purse of youth homelessness is £8.5 billion a year. And I'll break that down for you. That's £846 million a year on the criminal justice system, £492 million on homelessness services, £478 million on lower productivity, £473 million on social security, £456 million on NHS services, £140 million on mental health services, and £124 million on substance misuse services. And the economic loss generated by one homeless young person per year is equivalent to the average salary of a police officer. And as we've already heard, the number of young people facing homelessness last year was almost 136,000. That number continues to go up year on year. We know, to put that into perspective, that therefore a new young person faces homelessness every 4 minutes. I haven't been checking my watch, but I think that that's roughly two more young people since I started speaking who faced homelessness. Yet every pound spent in additional services for young homeless people can generate more than double that amount in terms of benefits. So what now? I always start with the bleak stuff, but what now? We can't just keep watching the clock to see how many more young people face homelessness as the minutes go by. We have to do something. We have to keep applying pressure for the new government to stick to their commitment to a strategy for ending homelessness and to include a youth-specific element of that strategy. Now, as a policy person and campaigner, I am often asked what I would do to support vulnerable homeless young people if I had a magic wand. Well, firstly, I think it's important to point out that a brand new government with a strong electoral mandate and an ideology based on social justice has quite a powerful magical wand. But my answer is that the most straightforward way to help young people as costs are escalating is to increase universal credit. It's that simple. In terms of the medium and longer term solutions, there are three key areas to focus on. But again, it's not that hard. The first is local government. We know that when young people approach local government for help, they often aren't able to get it. Local government needs funding to be able to plug the gap. We need to provide at least £330 million to local authorities to assess and support young people facing homelessness. Luckily, we have a spending review coming up next year where just such a thing could happen. The second is housing. If we're ever going to end homelessness, we need to end the housing emergency. We need to build social housing and replenish the housing stock that has been decimated over the last several decades. At Shelter, we are calling for 90,000 social homes to be built every year in order to redress the balance and meet the housing need. A portion of those homes will need to be one-bed and studio homes suitable for young people, and they need to be allocated to young people. And thirdly, we need to improve access to employment for young people in supported accommodation. At the moment, too many young people are trapped in supported accommodation when they want to move on. There are solutions. And to underpin all of this, we need the government to commit to a strategy for ending youth homelessness. Now, the new Labour government and the Mayor of London have publicly committed to growth. But how can we grow as a country whilst we leave our young people behind? The solutions are simple, and I urge you all to get behind them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lily. I'm going to move straight on to our next speaker, but do please keep in mind the questions and reactions that I'm sure you have to Lily's very powerful presentation, so that you can put them to us when the panel have finished. So I turn now to Ellie Benton, who is an experienced qualitative research officer in the LSE Housing and Communities Group within the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion. She works on a range of topics impacting low-income communities, including helping to organise the Housing Plus Academy events, which seek to empower people working in communities, low-income communities around the country. Ellie's going to discuss work that she has carried out with Laura Lane and Ruby Russell, and in partnership with the New Horizon Youth Centre that Tito mentioned in her introduction, that really focused on barriers that young people experience in accessing local authority support, and looking at ways in which local authorities and the voluntary sector could work more effectively together. Over to you, Ellie.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here. So just to give you a bit of background, the motivation for carrying out the research came from work carried out originally by New Horizon, which estimated that almost half of all young people experiencing homelessness do not contact their local authority at all or face barriers in doing so, and only 38% of those who actually do manage to contact their local authority receive a positive outcome. So we wanted to kind of investigate why this is and understand those barriers. So as part of the research, we spoke to young people in London who are experiencing or have experienced homelessness, as well as representatives from charities, local authorities, and local government. So I'll start by just talking you through some of our findings from the interviews with young people. Firstly, young people often feel like they're not listened to or understood by local authorities. Interviewees often reported feeling like the local authority staff didn't care about their situation or just weren't taking their situation seriously. Some were told being kicked out of their home just wasn't a big deal. And one interviewee said they were made to feel like a criminal, and a number of interviewees said they were made to feel like they were lying about their situation. Interviewees reported local authority staff avoiding talking to them or making eye contact, and one young person even reported a staff member pretending not to recognise them. Some young people commented that young men and boys were treated differently within the system and by local authority staff. Young men and boys were expected to be tough and just get on with things and were not seen as vulnerable, and they felt they were not offered as much support as the girls, which we thought was really interesting. Secondly, local authorities often placed unrealistic demands on young people in terms of providing evidence about their situation. Young people often found it difficult to prove that and difficult to secure the evidence that was being asked for. For example, one participant was asked to provide evidence of their family discriminating against their queer, non-binary identity, and their experience was not taken seriously until they were put into so-called conversion therapy. Similarly, another participant found it difficult to provide evidence of a domestic abuse situation as they had not been reported it to the police. Participants also said that it was difficult to provide official documents and evidence of being kicked out due to the nature of their strained family relationships. The local authority often struggled to understand their complicated family situations, for example, calling a parent or guardian to confirm what had happened, which young people felt could make the relationships worse. In one case, a young person's guardian falsely claimed that they hadn't kicked the young person out, and this made it a struggle to get local authority support from then onwards. Thirdly, young people felt there was a lack of clarity in local authority systems, which made them difficult to navigate. Young people expressed confusion over what support was available and how to ask for help. One young person said they were so confused by the situation, they ended up just not asking for any help at all. This confusion went beyond just how to ask the local authority for help. One young person said that young people often didn't know about the wider support available for them from different organisations such as New Horizon. Young people reported that communication from local authorities was often poor. They're not giving clear advice or passed from person to person, meaning they gave up asking for help. One young person reported that all communication they had went via a charity that was supporting them when they would have preferred direct communication. Another young person said they would have appreciated transparency about what support local authorities could and could not realistically offer them, instead of being unclear, which meant they did not know what next steps to take. Furthermore, across the young people we spoke to, there were big variations in the help they received. One young person had been housed immediately after presenting as homelessness, and for others it had taken years to be placed in permanent accommodation. One person who had been provided with a flat was supported with furniture and decoration, while others were told they had to sort this out for themselves. Two young people who had moved to London after being in care were told they were not eligible for support because they had no local connection. On the other hand, one young person who had experienced domestic abuse had been given a social property in an inner London borough where they did not have a local connection. It was not clear to the young people why some people were able to secure a flat while others found it completely very difficult. Another key theme is where support was offered by the local authority, young people explained that it was often inappropriate or inadequate. For example, one young person who had experienced domestic abuse was placed in a mixed gender hostel. Another young person spoke about being placed in a hostel with people with drug and alcohol dependence issues, which understandably made them feel very unsafe. Young people were concerned that if they refused this accommodation, they would be considered intentionally homeless and not eligible for any more support. However, it's important to point out this was not the case for everyone. Another participant spoke positively about being offered appropriate single-sex accommodation or age-appropriate accommodation. However, in another example, a participant presented as homeless to his local authority at age 17, but was not given the option to be fostered and given a personal advisor, which he was entitled to in accordance to Section 20 of the Children Act. He felt he was forced into a hostel without being told his options as a child under 18. One participant was told they would be supported into private renting, but the only assistance he was offered was a £2,000 deposit. But there was no assistance in actually finding accommodation or securing accommodation. He felt that the local authority was just dangling £2,000 in front of his eyes without knowing he wouldn't actually be able to access the support. One of the clearest themes that came through is the challenge of turning 18 and suddenly being seen as an adult who's expected to know where to go, how to do everything, while simultaneously the systems and the structures that protect children disappear overnight. One young person's experience illustrated this well. They'd been placed in hostel accommodation at age 17 and were never chased for their rent. After years of building up rent arrears, the hostel finally chased them. While they understood it was their responsibility to pay, they felt that as a child they should have received more support and guidance, and someone should have explained to them the importance of paying their rent on time and how to do this. His arrears from the hostel have meant he's no longer eligible for a social housing property. Several young people spoke about the importance of having an advocate when interacting with the local authority. A number of young people felt they were only listened to when they had a charity advocating on their behalf and felt this was the reason they eventually received help. For example, one young person was asked to provide evidence of their domestic abuse, such as police reports, which they did not have. It was only when the charity supporting them made a complaint that the local authority removed this requirement and they were provided with a social property. Finally, young people need more than just housing support. Help with jobs and education is crucial to helping the young people rebuild their lives. And several young people spoke about wanting to get back to education and work. Finally, young people have been through traumatic experiences and need help to support them process these events. Young people emphasised of having the importance of having a person who cares about them and they can rely on. And several participants highlighted the holistic support offered by New Horizon as particularly beneficial. So now I'm just going to talk you very quickly through our findings with stakeholders. Our interviews with stakeholders supported our findings from the interviews with young people and highlighted the immense pressure local authority services are under. They identified a number of factors that would improve the service delivered to young people, including the need for multi-agency working with local authorities and third sector organisations, more preventative work, for example, family mediation services, more appropriate housing solutions, and better funding to support young people, for example, unfreezing the local housing allowance. So, from both sets of interviews and desk-based research into good practice case studies, we've come up with several recommendations to improve the support received by homeless young people. We held a sense-checking roundtable to present these recommendations to local authorities and charities to ensure they are useful, realistic, and achievable. At a local authority level, we recommend the co-location of council housing and other statutory and voluntary services, including mental and physical health, education, training, and advice. Holistic and wraparound support to meet young people where they are. As part of this more holistic support service, council housing teams should undertake training on specific needs of young people and how best to support them. Young people should be provided with gender and age-appropriate accommodation, where possible via a needs assessment, with better sharing of facilities across local authorities. At a London level, we recommend London councils should help create a pan-London centralised website for young people, setting out the rights and the options available to them if they become or are threatened with homelessness. It would help identify help available within each borough alongside the voluntary support services. A pan-London reciprocal should be established to ensure underutilised housing stock and void properties can be brought back into use for young people, and to ensure more effective sharing of resources and facilities across boroughs. And finally, at a national level, we recommend the Homelessness Code of Guidance should be updated to include a specific chapter on engaging with and offering exemplary support to young people at risk or experiencing homelessness. And finally, the government should commit to a national strategy to end youth homelessness and focus on specific allocations for new housing that meet the needs of young people. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ellie, and ending there on the recommendation for a national strategy that, of course, was very much what Lily was arguing for as well. I'm going to turn now to Megan Roach, the final member of our panel, who is Director of Operations at the New Horizon Youth Centre. New Horizons Youth Centre, for those of you who don't know, is a day centre for homeless young people in King's Cross. Megan there oversees frontline services and leads on safeguarding and piloted London's first youth-specific emergency accommodation scheme. And she's worked in young people's services for more than 10 years, so brings a wealth of experience. And I think she's going to discuss work that's being carried out by support organisations to explore best practice. Thank you, Megan.
Hopefully you can hear me okay. So hi everyone, I'm Megan. As introduced, I'm Director of Operations at New Horizon Youth Centre. So we support young people across the city. We support about 1,500 young people each year who are under the age of 25 from varying circumstances. So some will be street homeless, others will be safe surfing with friends. We have quite a significant proportion over the last year who were recently evicted from asylum hotels, and others will be in insecure or inappropriate accommodation. It's really timely to be discussing this topic this evening because we've had the latest rough sleeping stats, which are showing that rough sleeping among under 25s has gone up by 41%. As mentioned, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the headline solutions that we had, both from the report that was produced, but also what we hear from young people on a daily basis, and just share some best practice examples from across the UK that I think we could consider potentially replicating to improve the solutions. So the three that I often refer to, the first one is that prevention is key and really critical. It seems really obvious, but we want to avoid young people finding themselves homeless in the first place. Often whenever I'm doing presentations and talks, there's a key stat that I always refer to, and that's that over half of adult rough sleepers first experience homelessness when they're under the age of 25. So it's really critical that we avoid missing that opportunity with young people when they're at that age, particularly with what Lily was talking about earlier in terms of average life expectancy. Often at New Horizon, we also speak about those missed opportunities, and we find that young people come to us when they've fallen through various statutory gaps in services, and actually they probably should have had the intervention much earlier on, but for whatever reason, they've been unable to navigate the system, or they've been let down, or they've not been believed, and then they often fall on to voluntary sector organisations for support. So prevention is key. That was my first headline solution. The second one is that we want the solutions to be youth specific and to really prioritise young people's safety. So compared to adults, young people are much more vulnerable when they're facing homelessness. They face greater discrimination in terms of the housing that they can access, how much they're paid, their employment prospects and rights. They're frequently, as Ellie was saying, they're not listened to, they're not believed, they're asked for unrealistic evidence, and then often they're rejected essentially, and then feel really worried about returning back to ask for support again. So it's really important those solutions are designed with young people in mind and really think about the specific nature of the trauma that they might have experienced that's led them into their situations of homelessness, which so often is family breakdown of some kind. And then the third one is that collaboration is essential. So I think this gets talked about as a word all the time. Most organisations have it as one of their central values, but often what we find is that collaboration can be really challenging. It can take more resource, more time. So really thinking about how as voluntary and statutory organisations we can be doing collaboration in a smarter, more meaningful way. So it doesn't take loads of resource. We're not reinventing the wheel every time, but we're just getting people in the same room so we can have that communication together and really think collaboratively about solutions. So a couple of best practice examples that I just pulled out, which I think align to those three potential solutions, and these are from various areas of the UK. And these are also highlighted in the report for anyone that's had access to that. So the first one was East Sussex Local Authority and their offer for their care leavers. So they recognise that young care leavers are increasingly vulnerable to facing homelessness later in life, and at New Horizon they make up a third of the young people that we see. They'll have had some kind of care experience before the age of 25. There was a young person that was interviewed as part of the research. He said, you know, it was assumed that because I'm a care leaver, I've got this whole package of support and it's really easy for me. But actually, in reality, care leavers also fall through the gaps. And unless they have really excellent wraparound support at that transitional age of 16 to 18, often they will be placed in independent accommodation at 18 with no support, and so often will fall behind on their rent payments, etc., or may be vulnerable to exploitation. So in East Sussex, they start the conversations at 16, start talking about move on at that point, and they create a personalised pathway plan with every young person. And they reach young people at that really critical moment where they're likely to be well engaged with their social worker, their school, living in stable accommodation, and then can really think about what their move on options are before they get to that crisis point. That's then picked up when they're 17, and they're given three offers of interim supported accommodation to help sort of that step down into fully independent accommodation. And then up until the age of 25, they get that intensive wraparound support, things like financial assistance, managing your tenancy for the first time, if you think they don't have a family to fall back on. So they're doing all of that independently. So East Sussex, in terms of the local authority and the leaving care team, provide that support. So it really ensures that young care leavers understand their rights and entitlements. And so we see so many young people coming in at, say, 21 and 22, and they've missed out on a whole package of support, and we try and do those claims then retrospectively. And just avoids that ending to their children's services experience being traumatic, which again is often something that we find with young people. The second one, so I couldn't come and not talk about one of our own programmes, so I'm just going to talk about the London Youth Hub, which you mentioned earlier in your introduction. So we piloted that back in 2021, so sort of coming out of the pandemic, so we're into sort of the fourth year of delivery. And we work in partnership with DePaul UK on London's only youth-specific emergency accommodation hub. So I think often people are, oh, there must be 10 of those across the city, and there is just one. And there is only 26 bed spaces for young people, but they get a 2 to 3 month stay, and it's for young people who are already currently rough sleeping or they're at imminent risk of rough sleeping. So again, it links back to what I mentioned about prevention. If a young person is going to be rough sleeping that night, they're presented at a voluntary sector organisation rather than waiting for them to be verified officially, which we know so many young people are missed because they don't rough sleep in the same ways as adult counterparts might. They can have a referral directly into the youth hub. And then there's an on-site team who firstly focus on move on specifically for that age group, so referring into youth-specific hostels, youth-specific private rented schemes, also local authority commissioned accommodation for those that are eligible. And then there's also a team that provide that holistic offer of support on a day-to-day basis that includes health and wellbeing activities, jobs, education and training. So it really reduces young people getting lost in adult services, and also reduces the length of time that they're sort of waiting in an environment that isn't suitable for their age and their needs. Whilst they wait for long-term accommodation, so avoids potential exploitation and also avoids them developing more complex needs that they might not have had when they first moved into the emergency accommodation. So that one, I hope, is quite a good example of youth-specific and really prioritising the safety of young people. And then the third one, back to my collaboration point, was in reference to St Basil's in Birmingham. So they're also a voluntary sector organisation supporting young people facing homelessness. And they co-locate their services with Birmingham City Council, so that includes the Children's Services team, it also includes the Housing Department, working alongside them as a voluntary sector organisation. So they have similar services to us, you know, a physical drop-in, referrals into housing, street outreach services, but really key is that they're the single point of referral for all commissioned young people's accommodation in the city. And they have amazing stats, so they prevent 91% of young people experiencing homelessness when they approach them. And again, going back to the really simple points of not trying to make partnerships overly complicated, it's having people in the same room together so they can communicate, they've got those trusting relationships. I think often you can get into this narrative within voluntary sector organisations which blame the local authority for everything, and actually that's not that helpful, they're really under-resourced at the moment as well. They've got unprecedented levels of demand. So in Birmingham, they've got that those people in the same room together. They can build that relationship. Live options are available there and then, and they can also support the engagement with young people. So a young person's got a trusted advocate in, say, a youth worker, in the room, in the meeting with a local authority representative. So it just kind of breaks down those layers of red tape that we can often see. So yeah, that was just a little bit of a taster, I guess, of some of the solutions that do exist, often in sort of small pockets locally, and back to what we've said today in terms of a national strategy for youth homelessness. It would be great to see those sorts of examples being rolled out more nationally, because they're proven to work, and they do work for young people specifically. So yeah, that was it from me.
Thank you very much. Fantastic. So now a chance to come over to you, both online audience and those of you in the room. Let me check first whether we have any questions online. Yep. Can we take one or two of those, please? Do you need the microphone?
Thank you. So, yeah, a couple of questions. We've got a few online. I'll just go with a couple for now. One is, what practically can the police do to support homeless young people? And another, what opportunities and challenges do you think the recent change in government presents for tackling the issue of youth homelessness? Although I know the panelists have spoken about that.
Thanks very much. That's great. Okay, so what practically can the police do to help homeless young people, and what risks and challenges do the new government present? Lily, would you like to start with one or other of those?
Yeah, absolutely. So great questions, and I'll start with the police one, obviously. The first thing is to not criminalise homelessness, and this is something that we're talking about a lot at the moment. We're talking about a lot in the last year with the previous government's criminal justice bill, and the conversation we were having was around primarily the fact that the police have an obligation to support the young people they see and direct them towards the correct services. An issue that we've seen over the course of the past decade, perhaps even longer, was of looking at young people who are experiencing homelessness, and you will see them in the most visible form of homelessness, so I'm talking street homelessness, and criminalising them, be it through laws to do with begging or nuisance or things such as that. Ultimately, you're entrenching the problem further, because the reality is, if you see someone on the streets, if they're under the age of 25 or any age, the likelihood is that they've experienced a huge amount of trauma. So the first thing is to treat them with care and kindness and not to criminalise, to recognise the rationale behind why they're there, and second of all, or finally rather, to signpost to correct services. That's crucial. Unfortunately, we don't necessarily see that. The statistics show that a lot of young people have been criminalised who are on the streets, but there is so much more that can be done, and police have powers to do those things, but at the moment we are seeing a bit of a struggle there.
Thank you very much. Ellie?
I'd echo everything that you said on the police. I think on the opportunities for new government, I think one of the main things is obviously increased universal credit payments, but I think there's also something a bit kind of clever around. There's this big push to build new homes, but building the right homes in the right places, so we're not building them, you know, in the middle of fields nowhere where there's no community, there's no support structure. Young people aren't going to want to live there. We need infill properties, meeting the young people where they're at, with their communities, where they can be with their friends or their support structures. So I think in the push to build new homes, we shouldn't be rushing this. We need to be building the right homes in the right places to help the people that need it.
I can come in on the police point. So I think similarly to what Lily was saying in terms of not criminalising those that are risk seeking, I think a big thing that we see at New Horizons is actually, concerningly, it's for under 18s. We often get 16 and 17 year olds that approach us because there's been family breakdown and they should be automatically entitled, but the reality of actually doing that in practice isn't always the way. So often they might approach a local police station for support, or if they've been directed there perhaps by an outreach agency. And when it works really well, it's when you've got someone that's approachable there, they've got a safe space for them to be while they contact children's services. And that a big problem we have is around adultification. So it's that assumption that, oh, well, you're 17 and a half, so you're basically an adult, or even if you are 18, you're only just. So it's assumed that you'll be okay, you'll manage. So actually having that more empathetic approach is what we really like to see. And we have some really good relationships with local police in Camden, where we're based. There's been some really good examples of when the police have kind of worked in partnership with children's services to really safeguard that young person and hold, for example, the local authority to account. But yeah, there is definitely some work to be done, particularly around 16, 17, like transitional age range.
Thank you, Megan. Yeah,
Lily. If I can also just come in on the point about opportunities and challenges, I think there are two really key points to make. So the first is that this election that we've just been through poses an opportunity for a generational shift in housing and homelessness. If we think about previous generations, be that Margaret Thatcher, be that when we talk about the establishment of the NHS, we have seen governments, political parties, at moments where they have been able to really determine the course of social justice, social policy in a country, off the back of the number of crises that we've seen in recent years that I sort of talked about when I spoke earlier, we are sort of in one of those moments now. Actually, I won't say sort of, we're absolutely in one of those moments now. And in shifting to a new government, this government has the mandate and opportunity to really make a difference, specifically on housing policy. There really is an opportunity to reverse the things that we've previously seen, and we saw a bit of that in the budget last year. We saw good signs about what might happen around right to buy, which has been a really huge issue in terms of causing the housing emergency. So first of all, I think I want to say that this government has a great opportunity to turn the dial, make a difference, shift our collective understanding of what is and isn't possible around homelessness, and shift the way that we talk about and think about people experiencing homelessness, and specifically young people. But the second point that I'll make is both a challenge and an opportunity. So economically, I talked a lot about the cost of living crisis, because ultimately nobody has much money at the moment, and that is because we are in a position economically which isn't great at the moment. But we're not, government policy is not austerity anymore. And so whilst we're in an economically challenging position, this is a moment for the government to shift away from the way that we collectively talk about economics in this country, so that we can invest in the right things for the right people and for the right services. Whereas there was previously maybe a sense of sort of fighting for scraps of, you know, there was a narrative around, you know, benefits cheats, or there was a narrative around we can pay for this but we can't pay for this. That's not the world we're in anymore, because we're not in austerity. So a great opportunity is to shift away from talking about austerity, so that we don't have to feel as if you pay for this service, you can't pay for that service. Actually, we can support lots of different people, because we're meant to be in a different economic policy environment now.
Thank you. I'll turn to the audience in the room just to indicate if you have a question. So we could go over here first, please. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. It's lovely to be with you. My name is Zulam. I'm an alum here. Thank you, firstly, for all you do. It's really important work, and I know you're making a huge difference. But there's been so many numbers that have been shared with us, lots of policy, and it can feel, especially to me, very nebulous and quite difficult to grasp. Can each panelist please give me one thing, or us one thing we could do to improve the situation?
Thanks very much. And was there a question over here somewhere? Yep. Thank you. I'll come to you first.
Hi, thank you very much. I just wanted to ask, we just talked about a shift away from austerity. Yeah. Should the shift be more towards equality? Because I feel there's a discrimination when you look at the room rate and the fact the lower universal credit rate for young people. I'm not quite sure what happens to a person when they turn 35 that suddenly means that they can have a one-bed rate. Yeah. And I think that kind of goes hand in hand with the fact that there are no more HMOs out there. There is no more accommodation. I'd just be interested to hear what the panel thinks would be the answer to that, possibly.
Thanks very much. Okay, so Ellie, one thing that you would do, and should we move from austerity to equality?
I mean, the obvious one thing is build loads of great houses and put people in them, but a kind of more practical, quick level, I think just believe young people. They're not lying, they're not doing this for fun. They are in a dire situation and they need help and they need to be treated like with respect. And I think there's a bit of a dichotomy of you're expecting people to be treated like adults, but then you're not giving them straight answers about what you can and cannot offer them. So I think treat young people with respect, listen to them, meet them where they're at, show them you actually care and you're trying to help, even if there are limits to what you can do. On the equality thing, I think this youth homelessness issue is not kind of in a bubble, is it? There's a wider housing crisis. We've got a temporary accommodation crisis. We've got an overcrowding crisis. I think we need a much more joined up solution to all these things, and maybe part of the problem is we haven't been thinking in a joined up enough policy environment. I don't really know, it's quite a complicated situation, but I think we need more joined up thinking about how we are tackling all these separate issues.
Yeah, one thing it's hard to pick. I think the same as listing definitely is important. I guess probably what stands out to me is what works really well is when young people have an advocate. So often that is from voluntary sector organisations, but there's so many amazing examples of how advocacy can work in different ways. And so it's enabling young people to kind of have their voices heard, essentially, and they've got a trusted advocate that can support them through that process. I think that can just make the whole shift from homelessness into then stable accommodation much less traumatic, having that person. And then, yeah, totally on your point, we always think that what kind of happens once you turn 35. So there is definitely a massive issue around equity, and I think also recognising that young people are likely to face additional barriers, so it's not deliberate, it's not treating them exactly the same as adults in that sense, so that's why I prefer sort of focus on an equity approach. There's been some positive things, sort of the new government in terms of slightly rising or increasing the minimum wage for under 21s, I think it is, at a faster rate than from everybody else. So I think that is a positive step, but we do need to see more of that in terms of universal credit, entitlements to independent accommodations, and your only offer if you're under 35 essentially at the moment is shared accommodation, which doesn't work for everybody. And then magically when you turn 35, that's when you can live on your own, apparently. So yeah, definitely there's a lot to do. I think often, to your point earlier about kind of youth homelessness can be its own sort of bubble, but often it represents wider systemic issues in society. So for example, the young people that we support, Black young people are massively overrepresented in the stats, so that is relevant to wider society. And so again, thinking about the additional barriers that many young people, particularly in London, are going to face to get out of homelessness, so really taking that equitable approach.
Thank you. Lily?
Yeah, thank you both, really great questions. So to the first one, one thing to improve the situation, I have lots to say. I think first and foremost, I think you have to look at it in two frames. One is government, one is the people. So in terms of the government, increase universal credit. That is like the first and foremost, the one thing they can do, increase universal credit. There's lots of things that could happen, but ultimately young people don't have enough money. That's the number one. In terms of what we can do as people, I think it's important as people that we shift both our rhetoric and our tone in terms of the way that we talk about young people and the way that we talk about homeless people, and also the way that we talk about vulnerability. That's core because the government do what they do because the electorate allows it to happen. And so there is something about shifting what we deem to be acceptable. I don't think I mentioned it here, but I often do when I use all of these stats, and it is really easy to become numb to them. But ultimately, I speak often with people who run helplines with young people, for example. When the cost of living crisis started to hit, I spoke to the helpline manager at Centrepoint, and I said, you know, are we hearing a lot about the cost of living? Are people giving us much information about it? Obviously, you know, I shared that young people have £4.60 at the end of each week to live. He said, no, they're not talking about the cost of living crisis. And it wasn't because they weren't talking about the symptoms of the cost of living. It wasn't because they weren't saying, I have no money to live. It's because the cost of living is just a buzzword. It's just warm words that politicians use instead of saying people don't have enough money. And so therefore, I think it's important for us not to lose sight of the people that we're talking about, which is why I sort of framed this all at the beginning with mentioning that this morning I was at a commemoration service for people who died because they were homeless, with an average age of 47 being when they died. We have to have greater kindness with the way that we talk about homeless people. We have to have better challenge when people talk about it. If you go and have a conversation with someone later about this, challenge them if they have any concerns or questions. I'm so used to telling people what I do, and 5 minutes in, eventually they'll be like, yeah, but some people kind of choose it, right? You know, we have to challenge that. We have to challenge that. And if we challenge that enough, more people will challenge it, and the government will listen. And then the question about austerity to equality or equity, kind of the same thing. Absolutely. I think when we talk about rights to housing, for example, whose rights are most in jeopardy, we need to talk about at shelter. We're going to come out soon with some research into race and housing, actually we see great racial disparities in terms of housing. We talk a lot about the fact that local authorities aren't able to provide enough services to young people especially, but then you look at who is getting those services when they are available. The disparities are kind of what you would expect to see. So actually, yes, we need to move away from austerity towards equality and equity. And we need to really understand where equity isn't happening at the moment. And I'm so sorry I'm talking really quickly because I know that I had a lot to say.
Thank you very much. Tito, did you want to come in
yeah.
on this?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question about what's one thing that we can do. I think it feels like such a big problem. I think homelessness in general feels huge, and then we're talking about young people who always have so many different issues in their personal lives, in their universities, in their communities. But I think I would say that through being a part of the LSE Homelessness Initiative, I think I've seen that partnership is, I think, a really good first step to tackling a huge issue. I think when you bring in different voices and different stakeholders, people who are working on these issues, often in silo, and you join them together, you get a lot of answers that you just can't get on your own. So for example, we have a new Homelessness Action Society, which started just this year, and now we've brought them into the Homelessness Initiative Board, which just from speaking to them already, I feel like we've got young voices, and we're hearing things that I don't think anyone else on the board would have been able to contribute. I think that's very, very special. So I think that partnership is a really good first step.
Thanks, Tito. Great. Do we have some more questions online? Yeah, could we take another two, please?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, so a question that was touched on earlier has come up a couple times online. I'll go for the slightly longer version. Given that shared accommodation available for rough sleepers in London is essentially impossible to access at the moment, do you think that the shared LHA rate might be scrapped or should be scrapped? And then, as a second question, what's the best way I can help a young person who is homeless when I see them on a street, on the street? And then a third related question, if I can, just because there's quite a few. How supportive, how effective is Homeless Link on the streets?
Thank you very much. Okay, so three questions there. Should shared LHA rate be abolished? How should we help a young person who we encounter on the street who's homeless, and is homelessness link effective? Shall I start with you, Megan? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. I guess the second two I can probably talk about most. So best way to help, I think, from what we talked about today, the not prejudging is really important, so not making assumptions about what's led that person to be there, because often that is wrong and it feeds into negative stereotypes. So there are practical ways to support. I assume the second question is referring to Street Link, potentially, as opposed to Homeless Link. So I think that's the app that people are hopefully aware of in terms of coordinates all of the outreach services in London. So we do encourage always young people and those that witness young people who are asleep in to register on there. There is mixed, definitely, responses, and that is because rough sleeping is so high and it's such a crisis point in London, it wouldn't be possible, I don't think, for anyone to get round everyone in the way that they would hope to. And often also young people are not going to stay in the same places where they're rough sleeping. They're not just going to be outside one shop doorway all night because it's not safe for them to do so. They're likely to face abuse and exploitation if they do, so they will move around. So there's definitely improvements that can be made in terms of how we carry out, you know, outreach services to be able to assist. So we have a youth-specific outreach team at New Horizon. They go out twice a week, and it's thinking about where we can target young people in sort of those non-traditional ways. So, you know, young people that might be sleeping on buses, so that's a sense of safety for them. Or young people that, you know, might be also sofas having one night, but then rough sleeping, they're not necessarily consistently rough sleeping all week. There's probably some tweaks that can be made there, but I think there's definitely something about not making those assumptions. If you can offer practical assistance, you know, a Street Link alert, that is always helpful. Or if people are aware of local services that exist, letting young people know. I don't think anyone's expecting that people are going to be going out every night and, you know, saving people that are rough sleeping. That's not kind of, I don't think we want to feed into that either in terms of that's a way to help. So I think that's why the prejudging and not making those negative stereotypes is actually a more impactful way to support. Thank you.
So the first question, I don't think I wrote it down in full, so I just wrote scrap LHA, but I think that was the depth of where we were getting at. I think ultimately the point is that people don't have enough money, and I think that's the starting point. And so I think part of the difficulty I have, so my role kind of is both policy and it's campaigning, and one of the many things that I find in campaigning is that we can focus on an area where you take one thing away, you don't get what you need. And so as much as I do think there are issues with LHA, the primary thing is that people don't have enough money. So raise universal credit, make LHA fit for purpose, make sure that people have enough money in their pockets. That's where I would start. The question of how can I help a young person I see on the street, I would echo exactly what Megan said. Lead with kindness, ultimately. I don't think that there is a one-size-fits-all of how to help anybody that you see on the street. I think it ultimately comes down to your own instinct, but I think it has to start with kindness. And too often I see people walk past people on the streets, walk in a way that, you know, just kind of knock into them, kind of act as if they're not there. People are people is the starting point. Recognize that these are human beings. If you feel comfortable giving them money, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That's a very personal recommendation. That's not my organization saying that. If you feel comfortable giving them money, if you feel comfortable giving them food, absolutely do that. If you'd rather give them, the link to somewhere to go or information about where to go, absolutely do that. But the second thing that I will say is that if you do see a young person on the streets, please call the Centrepoint helpline. You can find that online. It's available 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. You can give it to the young person to make the phone call, or you can call for them and they can signpost them towards services. And it's a similar point around street link, I would say. I'll talk too much if I don't stop there.
Yeah, I think on the question around what you can do if you see a young person who is sleeping on the street, I think it's really important to think about them. Let's say you live in an area and there's someone who's young who you see living on the street. They actually are a part of your community. And I think at LSE, you know, we have people who are homeless who live on our campus. And I think there's been a real shift in seeing them as a part of our LSE community, which I think has been very important. And it's actually led to some great campaigns to get them to be more incorporated into everyday life on campus. And I think that's how it should be treated for a young person who's in your area, in your community, or even not in your community. Let's say you're somewhere else. I think that they should be seen as a part of, they should be seen as a neighbor, essentially, because that's where they live. So I think they should be treated as the way you would treat your neighbor. And I also think that it's very important to consider, as you said, like acting with kindness. And also I think eye contact and just acknowledging someone's presence is very important. I think if someone, and I'm sure there's a lot of research on this, that if someone was to ask you for money and you didn't have money, even just looking them in the eye and saying, I'm really sorry, I actually don't have any money, is acknowledging their presence and just treating them as a human being.
I echo everything everyone's just said about how to help people. Just to comment on local housing allowance, I think scrapping the shared local housing allowance could potentially help, but I think it would be within limits. I've done some other work looking at private renting as a step in for, as a hold in for social housing, and there's a massive problem at the moment in London that local housing allowance just isn't meeting the private renting rent, so people are having to be housed further and further and further out of London. So I think scrapping the shared local housing allowance and putting it up to the general local housing allowance, I just don't know how much it would really help in the grand scheme of like how the housing market is working at the moment. And I think more needs to be done to provide cheaper, ideally social housing accommodation.
Thanks, Helly. Okay, back to the room. Question here in the front. And then we'll go to this row here, the next one.
Thank you. I was just wondering what...
Can you say who you are and where you're from as well?
Oh, sorry. I'm Jess. I'm from LSE Housing and Communities. I work with Ellie. I was just wondering what you know about the level and scope of hidden homelessness amongst young people, and particularly, do we have any statistics about young people who are part of LSE who may also be homeless?
Okay, and then there's one here. And then just next to Jess here, please, in the front row. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Iris from Partnership for Young London. I don't know if I've a question yet, but just a thought. So if homelessness is less about the unavailability of homes, but more about, for example, your statistic of people are made homeless by family, so social relations, this might not be a sector then for private renting or for homeownership, but what can big housing providers do in that space if it's not about the roof, but more about the social relations?
And in the front here, thanks.
My question fits very closely with that. So I'm very struck by all the speakers using the word kindness several times. And I do think that large parts of our society have become very unkind. But I first came across network housing, through network housing, because network housing is a housing association that was offering several of its homes split into single room supports for young people from New Horizons. And it was an incredibly impressive project. I was taken to visit New Horizons by network housing. And I just think if there was a way of inspiring kindness among organizations that are not for profit and that are declared kind organizations, i.e. local authorities and housing associations, we could probably solve youth homelessness. If we just pushed that, first of all, the kindness, and secondly, the sharing of space, and thirdly, the support for young people that they need, because I think one thing that maybe has been slightly underplayed in my experience by all the speakers is just how complicated it is to run supported housing for young people, particularly if they've been through traumatic experience and they're not skilled at managing. And that's where the network project in New Horizons is absolutely brilliant, because they bridge that gap. So I just thought, well, I'd be just interested in what the speakers think about that approach and how far it could be pushed. I mean, my idea is that it could open the door to thousands of units of accommodation. It could actually solve youth homelessness if the kind organisations were pushed a bit further on being kind.
Lovely, thank you. Okay, so three questions there on hidden homelessness, including possibly at LSE. The importance of social relationships and how housing providers might be able to support social relationships, and the idea of kindness as a kind of lead intervention idea to push with housing providers and the sharing of space through network housing. Tito, did you want to come in on particularly perhaps on that question of hidden homelessness? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in the LSE Student Union, we have a team called the Advice Service Team, and they are staff who work primarily to give advice to students in any circumstance. So a student can fill out a form on the LSESU website basically saying, I have financial problems, I might be evicted, etc. And then they will get a face-to-face session with one of our staff, and then they will signpost them to relevant help resources. And also, this is connected to our hardship fund, where students who might be facing an eviction if they don't pay their rent, or maybe they've had a random firing from a part-time job, they can apply and we can give them financial help. And I think this is really important because it also comes with data on the students who are applying for this hardship fund and for this advice service. So we know that if there are students who are at risk of homelessness or who are already homeless, we do have that data. Yeah, so they're not going under the radar, but there's still more to be done, of course.
Lily, do you want to come in next?
Yeah, so lots of hidden homelessness. It's a really important question, and it especially impacts young people. So hidden homelessness being the sorts of homelessness that's just that, it flies under the radar. We don't have the official statistics on it because it means it's people who are using informal means to house themselves, essentially. So people who are sleeping on buses, sofa surfing, and so on. And often that is what we find amongst young people. And we find that it tends to be women, young people, children. Those tend to be the sorts of populations of people who are hidden homeless. And it's generally because of their protected characteristics is why you find them amongst the hidden homeless. But also, so the starting point being 136,000 young people approached their council in the last year because they were homeless or at risk of homelessness. only a third of them were able to kind of be seen and move through the process, which means we've got huge numbers of young people, not even, you know, we've got the stats, but they're not even moving through the process. And Megan, I hate to steal your stats, I might steal it incorrectly, but I know anecdotally, I think New Horizon, it's like double the number are even going to New Horizon. So that's already giving you a sense of the scale in its true reality. On top of that, if you think of no recourse to public funds, you've got all these people who aren't going to approach a council because they can't approach a council because they have no recourse to public funds. On top of that, if you consider, and this links back to the question about the police, a lot of young people who are experiencing homelessness are experiencing it having already gone through trauma upon trauma upon trauma and lots of systems failing them. So often you'll find people will have fallen through the gaps, be they the care system, education system, the justice system. The list of systems that I mentioned in terms of that 8.5 billion have failed thousands of young people, which means that they're probably not going to show up in the statistics because they stop trusting these institutions. So the scale of hidden homelessness, anecdotally, could be 50% more than I'm saying. I imagine it's even higher. The scale is off the charts. And I think the second part of your question was then, can we do more in terms of what's... I'm looking at the wrong person. This was your question. I've gone the wrong way. The question of could we do more in terms of the support that we give to... families, and absolutely, when we talk about prevention, a lot of it does need to be that wraparound care that we give to families. So family breakdown can be for a number of different reasons. So sometimes we're talking about things that are intractable and there's not much that we can do, but also one of the things that we anecdotally hear, for example, on our helpline was that, let's say, the cost of living crisis hit. We've talked about hidden homelessness, so a lot of people are sofa surfing, but actually people might be sofa surfing in homes that people can no longer afford an extra person on their sofa, and that's why people are no longer there. Or family breakdown might be caused by money. Often money is the root of all evil, all sorts of problems, which will come to my point in answer to the question about kindness. But if you're in a home where there isn't enough money, there are four kids, your eldest is 17, you often find that 17-year-old is then sent to go and look after themselves. So money often is that starting point. So absolutely, intervention needs to start with holistic wraparound care for the whole family. But it also needs to start with money. People don't have enough money in this country. And actually, you probably can pinpoint where the issues might stem from and be caused in order to move through and help these young people before the problems begin.
Thank you. Megan?
Yeah, definitely was going to make the same point. Quite often, that's what's driven the relationship breakdown, is the home is overcrowded or there isn't enough money to go around in terms of the family. So that is a big proportion. So I think, yeah, housing providers do still have that responsibility to think about, you know, are homes actually fit for families that are in there? So there is practical things that can be done as well as the relationship mediation work that we've spoken about today. I think, yeah, the inspiring kindness and sort of the examples of best practice work that have happened where there's been, you know, collaborations between voluntary sector organisations and housing associations. So we've tried to push a lot more of that model because it works really well. But I think what we often come up against, again, is a funding challenge. It's that actually it costs more to run that model for young people. So in terms of value for money, potentially for the housing provider, they're not going to get the same as they would if they just put it out through their normal local authority pathway. And often young people don't access through the local authority pathway for all of the reasons that we've spoken about today. They're turned away, or they don't know where to access support, or they don't meet the threshold because they're under 35. So yeah, it'd be great to see sort of more innovative solutions like that, where housing associations are thinking, okay, we've got a 100-bed unit, we're going to make 10 of those units available for under 25s, and then partner with organisations who can support young people with that holistic wraparound offer, enable them to sustain their tenancies, avoid young people falling into rent arrears. So there are definitely those solutions out there, but you kind of need the financial commitment to start with to enable, whether it's the housing association or local authorities, to kind of make that commitment. But yeah, interesting. And yeah, the hidden homelessness we've already spoken about.
Yeah, I've just got a point to add on the kind of big housing providers playing their role. I had an interview with the chief executive of L&Q the other week saying one of the big challenges with housing supply at the moment is that the Section 106 properties being built, which are the affordable housing kind of charter that private developers have to meet, are not meeting the needs of what the housing associations want. They're one-bedroom properties. But I was just thinking these would be perfect for young people. So I think maybe more needs to be done to push the housing associations to take these one-bed properties, which are largely a lot of the time standing empty despite there's massive need for homeless young people, and working in partnership with people like New Horizon to manage them. So I just think there needs to be more done to push the housing associations to make use of the stock that has been built, instead of pushing for more family homes, which are obviously hugely important, but we could also help a lot of young people with these one-bedroom properties.
Yeah, the void space thing is really important, actually, that you've mentioned, because we know there are void spaces out there in accommodation, but often because you need to go through a specific pathway to access it, they just end up sitting empty. Mm-hmm. And actually, there could be some solutions there in terms of having a mix of emergency accommodation, so it is short-term, but the young person is being supported into moving on, rather than just avoiding there being homes sitting empty, particularly in London, where it's single bed accommodation, single room rather. So there is again ways to think more innovatively in terms of using those void spaces.
Thanks very much. Okay, I think we have another question online. If we could come here.
So this last question, how can we ensure that young people who escape homelessness don't find themselves back in that situation?
Thank you. And then can we pass the microphone a few rows further back, please?
Hi, hello. My name is Tanisha Rao, and I'm on the International Social Public Policy Masters. Thank you so much for the point that you made, Alicia. One of the things that kind of stuck out was this understanding that there are young people who fall out of different systems, and that there are gaps. And whether that's the education system, care, or just families breaking up and that sort of thing. But one of the questions that I have is, I work for a youth mentoring organization that specifically helps at-risk young people. And one of the major concerns is the transition age. So the moment that you're 16 and 17, your access to care exists, and there are councils that care about you, and people in local council members who want to help you, and voluntary sector that's there to help you. But the moment you switch to 18, you're kind of left to fend for yourself. And I see that this is a larger, broader question of, again, what does being a young person mean? To what extent can public sector, public welfare step in and help a young person? Because like you said, most people face homelessness under the age of 25. What can be done to address this legal aspect of an age requirement needed? And to what extent can this be solved? Would just a change in age matter? Would it be more a case of increasing the minimum wage for specific age groups? Because again, there is a certain view that, young people don't need to be paid that much because they probably belong to a double income household. And that's again a functional perspective on families, to say that everybody lives in houses with two parents who are heterosexual and have certain incomes. What would be the kind of big system point on that front?
Thanks very much. And we'll take one more just on the back row there.
Thank you so much for the excellent panel. I had a question of a lot of the solutions have come from the UK. Is anything innovative or you think is working well that you're seeing from other parts of the world, other countries? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we've got, and I'll come to you first if I can, Megan, we've got young people returning to homelessness, having escaped from homelessness and then returning. We've got the question about this difficult transition age, and the question about whether there's any innovation from overseas that we could draw on.
Yeah. Avoiding young people returning to homelessness. So I think part of that is what I mentioned in some of the best practice examples earlier in terms of the wraparound support. So often the young person may be living independently for the very first time. You don't go to school here and then get taught how to pay your bills and keep up with council tax and what all of that means in terms of your entitlement. So actually, if there can be that sort of transitional support and that wraparound offer. So there's various organisations that do it. Settle, for example, they do wraparound support for care leavers when they first move into accommodation, around that really practical support. And often when we support young people, they come to New Horizon, they access the day centre at the point where perhaps they're sleeping, they get housed, but we enable them to continue access and usually for a few months, so we can support with the independent living skills. Also, if they've experienced quite a lot of trauma as part of their homelessness, which often they have, they can access things like counselling, which then mean they're in a better position when they do finally move on from services to sustain the tenancies that they're in. And then there was a question about to what extent the transitional age, yeah, and the age range, and whether that would help. And I mean, potentially, but I don't know if that's probably not realistic in terms of, yeah, if you were to then, if there was a duty that then fell up to 18, would that make a difference? You would hope that care leavers would access that support, although we know in practice that doesn't always happen. I guess probably to the point that Lily made earlier in terms of calling, which we've been doing for several years, calling for a chapter in the Homelessness Code of Guidance and really recognising that young people need their own specific solutions, so it's less about the eligibility of the age, but more about recognising that under 25s are going to experience additional barriers, so having a set way that all local authorities work towards and set duties on them and support young people in a specific way. The international question always gets asked, and I always think I need to go and look and find out, and I never do, so I'll hand that over hopefully to someone else on the panel.
I don't have anything either on the international one, but we'll go and do some homework so we can find identify some case studies. On the kind of transitional age thing, I sort of feel like moving the age up might help a little bit, but you still would have that quite crude cutoff. And I think what needs to happen is more hand-holding through the process, that so people are kind of prepared for the changes and, where possible, kind of a less crude cutting off of services, maybe a kind of slowing down. But I think practically that is difficult because people might not necessarily have been engaged with the service long enough for that to happen. But I think where possible that does need to happen. And then I think, yeah, just echoing what you just said about the Homelessness Code of Guidance, people just having a better understanding of the needs of young people so they get a better kind of reaction when they present as homeless, I think would really, really help.
Thank you. Tito?
Yeah, I think those are also really good questions. I think the question around the cycle of finding yourself back in the same situation, I think, because as we've said, you know, there's a lot of hidden homelessness amongst young people, so I think it's very difficult for a lot of organizations to really target that. And in particular, I think with universities and student unions, I think that we definitely have not done enough incorporation of the hidden features of youth homelessness in our work to target it. And so I think it makes it harder for us to then help with young people, stopping them going back in those same patterns. So I definitely think that's something that needs to be more incorporated into that conversation. And on the question of the sudden transition of being 18, I think that a lot of further education institutions, colleges, sixth forms, I think there's a step missing. I think we see this a lot wider in general, that a lot of students come to university and they're lacking on just key life skills, to be honest. And I think that there's something that the government needs to do, clearly, I think, funding with colleges and sixth forms, but also creating programs where young people can be more equipped about the next stage of their life in general.
Lynn? Yeah, so great questions. The first one, in terms of young people being able to escape and stay out of homelessness, there's not much more I can say. I think that wraparound support is really fundamental, but there's also something about making sure that when people are ready to move on, that they're able to move on at the exact moment. So at the moment in supported housing, and I don't want to bore you with the technicality of this, but there is a real issue in supported housing of people being stuck in supported housing because of complicated issues around benefits rules and housing benefit, meaning that when people are ready to move on, they can't and they get trapped. That means that people remain in a place of trauma for often years longer than they need to be there, and that can mean that people aren't able to move on and properly escape trauma. So I think ensuring that when people are ready, they're properly supported to move on effectively is a really key one. But I'd also go to the question about innovative solutions from abroad there as well. So one thing we haven't talked about much on the panel is Housing First, which we do have in the UK, but Scandinavia does it incredibly well. And so if we just need to look abroad to where Housing First is working really well to say, actually, that's something that we could do here. And what we see with Housing First is that does help people to stay well. So when they get out of homelessness, they're able to stay out of homelessness. So I think of all of the things that we can look at from abroad, that's a really good one. And we do have examples here, but not enough, and we need to invest in Housing First. And the question of the transitional age is a really great one. And I think I have three different things to say, one of them immediate term and the other's longer. So the first thing is abolish priority need. So all of this conversation around transitional age and where the support happens and all these different things, often it's because we're talking about priority need. And often what we're talking about is local authority services and there not being enough to go around. The fact is, if you turn up at 18, you turn up at 16, you turn up at 20, everyone's got a need. You know, the idea of prioritisation is absurd, and we need to get rid of priority need. The second is that we need to actually establish what we mean by young people. So we're in this sort of ridiculous system whereby if you're 18, you don't make as much money as if you were 26. But equally, the idea is that you're 18, you can fend for yourself. But actually, no, you can't fend for yourself because you won't have enough money. It's absurd. We need to establish what we mean so that when people hit those points and those points of tension, we're actually able to support them as best as we possibly can. But then there is a longer term solution, because all of this is tinkering around the edges. Ultimately, there are not enough homes in this country. We need to build more social homes. The reason that we have this issue of priority need, the reason that we have the issue of local authorities gatekeeping, the reason that we have the issues of people of colour not getting the right amount of services, all of that is because ultimately we don't have enough homes and local authorities are doing the best they can with different bits of services here and there. So the code of guidance needs to be better, it needs to be clearer, it needs to be updated, and ultimately we need to build more social homes. And the final point I want to make that I haven't mentioned before, but I'm just going to fudge it in there, is that homelessness in many ways is a political choice. So we've talked a little bit about street homelessness on this panel. During the pandemic, there was a programme called Everyone In. Everyone In meant that literally it was that. All of the people on the streets were brought in and said, here is a home. Because in a pandemic, you can't have a bunch of people on the streets. Problem was that the government massively underestimated how many people were living on the streets and had to do a lot more work to ensure that those people were housed. But they were housed. But there's been a political choice to essentially undo that. And so a lot of what we're talking about is political choice. We can make things better. And ultimately, we need to just push the government to do that. Build social.
Thanks, Lily. Okay, I think we've got one final round of questions, maybe. So we'll take the one online, was there? And then to the person next to you.
Thank you. The person asking the question says, it sounds like a lot more could be achieved if different services didn't operate in silos. What are the most immediately available options to improve collaboration across services?
Thank you very much. Yes, Ruby.
We've spoken a lot about the role of the public sector, be it local authorities, housing associations, the voluntary sector. I wonder if you think there's a role for the private sector in this issue.
Thank you. And just here in the middle, and that would be our last question.
So we spoke a little bit kind of about sort of streamlining access to information for specific local authorities. But what role do you think like having a larger technical base for, because like, for example, you make a duty to refer for one council, they use Housing Jigsaw. You make a duty to refer for another council, they tell you the processing time is 8 weeks and then they refer you to Turning Point. So what role do you think that kind of having sort of like a more of a streamlined process for duty to refer would play in helping young people navigate the system? Because again, local connection, you don't have a blood relative, you don't work in the borough, you're not there 6 months, sorry, we can't help you.
Thanks very much. Sounds like a very well-informed question, so I'm guessing maybe you work in the sector. That's great. So questions about silos, how do we crack them, what role for the private sector, and is there a role for streamlining the duty to refer? Shall I come to you first, Ellie?
Yes, I'll speak on the first two. On collaboration across departments, I think kind of the gold model is what Lambeth have done, which is co-location of services. So everyone is physically in the room, which obviously helps staff and also helps the people receiving help. They know where they can go to one place, they can receive help from different services, there's better communication across services. Obviously, that is a big funding change and that takes a lot of work. I think we worked with Chester Council and they set up a homelessness collaboration group. I can't quite remember the name, but every month all the services that kind of supported people from homelessness met. So it was everything from the police, social services, NHS, and they all came together and they regularly met about the problems they were facing and what they were doing, and they found that really, really improved things. So just having conversations with people really does help. On the private sector, I think I'll go back to my point about Section 106 properties. The private sector are building properties, and I think if a greater push was made for these to be used for youth homelessness properties. The private sector do have a say in who these properties go to, so if there was greater awareness and greater push for them to be used for youth homelessness, I think that would be really good. And I think the other thing that could be said would be like providing work opportunities, which is not something we've really pushed. A lot of the young people we spoke to wanted to get into work, so maybe private sectoral organisations who were in the opportunity to offer work, working places like New Horizon to offer those opportunities would be quite a good solution. I don't know if that already happens, but...
Go ahead. So silos, yeah, similarly on the co-location, I wonder if there's also something around commissioning models. So often voluntary sector organisations, for example, might be commissioned by a local authority for a set period of time, which is often really short. So then they often then end up working in silos because they're just working on a really short project for a short period of time, and then that project drops away and it gets recommissioned. So I don't know if there's something around that, because I think that often we can find that's why we're all end up competing for the same pots of funding. And then delivering things very separate from each other, and actually if there was more longer-term joined-up funding opportunities, that might support. Similarly, in terms of what Ellie said on the private sector question, again, touching on some of the examples from earlier, you know, things like live and work schemes where private sector could be thinking about, okay, we're going to offer certain jobs opportunities, but we're also going to double that up and offer young people places to live. So it's not private sector funded, but there is an example of that in Birmingham as well in terms of a live and work scheme. So it's a place where it's, again, it's a subsidised rent for young people, which is more affordable, more in line with what they're likely to be paid at that time. So there are, again, small pockets that exist. Some companies do offer that, but that could be quite an interesting model to explore. And then the duty to refers, I guess, probably goes back to what Lily was saying earlier in terms of the priority need, because, yes, you could make a really great system because it is extremely clunky and it does differ depending on where you're referring, and the tracking is a nightmare, but would it make much of a difference if then ultimately where you get to is that they're not going to meet the threshold, which is often what we find. So yeah, interesting to explore though.
Thank you. Lily?
Yeah, I think maybe I'll just tackle the private sector question, because actually I feel like the other ones have been done quite well, although I've forgotten which face to look at, so I'm just going to go out to the crowd.
Private sector was
over here. Private sector. Yeah, so I think there's a huge role of the private sector. I think ultimately, in order to end any sort of societal ill, we need to look at all different sectors of society, because we all have a role to play in upholding or ending them, in the private sector for sure. There's different layers to it. So I think there's a private sector as employers. Ultimately, I think I said earlier that employment is going to be really important. Young people need to be employed, they need to stay employed. But the reality is that to employ someone who has had experience of homelessness or has been vulnerable to homelessness or is vulnerable to homelessness, it's not going to be necessarily the same as your traditional person who's currently in full-time employment. And so we need to make sure that all of our workplaces in some way are what we call psychologically informed. So we talk about psychologically informed or trauma-informed environments in the homelessness sector. We really should be doing the same in all sectors to make sure that people are able to be employed and stay employed. Equally, there's something about people who provide services such as McDonald's. Are they well trained to understand if someone comes in and they suspect that person to be homeless or at risk of homelessness? There's work that can be done there to refer those people to the correct services or to just support them in some way. There's examples of that happening internationally. There's examples of having that happening in the UK. There's more that we can do to put that onto a firm footing. And then finally, there's something about reimagining philanthropy in some way. So at the moment, we have great partnerships across different charities that work really well. I think of one between HSBC and Shelter at the moment, and with that, HSBC has created a world in which we can have bank accounts for homeless people. It sounds like a really simple thing, but people experiencing homelessness can't get a bank account. You can't get a bank account, you can't get a home. Really simple way of the private sector doing something. There's also something about flowing money from the private sector to activism or to advocacy or something like that, but reimagining what we mean when we talk about philanthropy, both in terms of the private sector as businesses, but also private individuals with a huge amount of wealth, how we make sure it's flowing to the right people in order to improve services and improve our society in some way as well.
Thank you, Lily. Tito, did you want to? I
don't even know how I can add much to what you said, because I completely agree with everything that was just said. I think on the question that was asked about streamlining like services, I would just say that we recently were talking with our students on our hardship fund, and there was a conversation around the form that people have to fill out, and it was quite long. It used to be kind of just bullet points of things that you need to consider in your application, reasons why we reject applications. And we actually had students tell us that just because of the length of that form, they weren't going to fill it out, even if they could access up to £3,000 of help. It was just so long, and they already were tired of going from place to place, application to application. So just the way it was structured and formatted was off-putting. And if we put it in the context of young people who may have been in and out of homelessness, they may have had family breakdown, they're emotionally exhausted, to say the least, and they're probably just fed up of the system. They probably feel like a lack of hope in it. So I think just a wider message I would say is, like, to anyone who was coming up with a way to help people, I think about the way it's presented to someone who is kind of on the last leg, because you're not going to want to read a 10-page document on how to apply for one thing. I think it could be very exhausting for people.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, thank you, audience, for excellent questions and commentary. And thank you, of course, to the panel, Ellie Benton, Megan Roach, Lily Walker, Tito Maloku. And I think it's been a fantastic discussion. We've had a lot of discussion about the problems, but we've also had a lot of focus on the solutions, which I really welcome, because if there's one thing that I criticise my own discipline of social policy for, it's focusing too much on the problems and not enough on the solutions. So I'm really glad that this evening's event has really corrected that imbalance, certainly for me. And we've had everything from very practical, immediate suggestions about what we can do as individuals when we encounter a young person on the street, to refer them to the Centrepoint helpline, to refer them to the Street Link app, right through to proposals for how we need to be influencing the current government to reform welfare in particular, to ensure that families' incomes are adequate, working on the preventative side of street homelessness for young people altogether. So thank you, and thanks. Let's join in thanking the panel.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.